everybody, and welcome to another edition of Second Sunday Crime. I'm Libby Helmet, and we are back. Actually, this is the second version, the second episode of Second Sunday Crime since I've been back with Authors on the Air. And I am delighted to have as my guest today Susanna Calkins. You may know her. If you don't, she is the award-winning author of the Lucy Campion's Mysteries, which is set in 17th century London. How many books were there in that?
There were four in that series.
Four in that series. So she started a second series. The first one is coming out very shortly. It's called The Speakeasy Mysteries, and it is set in a Prohibition era Chicago speakeasy. How much fun is that? Anyway, Susie holds a PhD in history and currently works at Northwestern University. She was born and raised in Philadelphia. She now lives in the Chicago area with her husband and two sons. And she teaches history, and she also does public speaking about historical fiction, research, providing effective techniques for libraries, universities, book clubs, and writers groups. So if you have a need or you want to find out more, I'm sure you can go to her website, which is susannacalkins.com, and find out lots more. Welcome, Suzanne.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, I'm glad you could. I'm glad we could arrange it in your busy schedule.
Yeah.
So I loved Murder Knocks Twice. It was, I call it a not so cozy book.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all that cozy, actually, when we got right down to it. But, there wasn't a lot of violence. There wasn't any violence really on the page either. So I don't know. What would you call it? Traditional?
Yeah, I guess I would call it traditional. I mean, every time people ask me about cozy, I always thought cozy was, you just curl up on a book with a blanket and your cat, and a cup of tea, and that's cozy. But apparently, that's not how the genre is defined. So I would say it's, traditional, historical mystery, traditional. It's a whodunit in that sense.
Yeah. And once I got into it, I really found it great. I found the writing very smooth, and I found the characters fun. And so tell us what it's about.
Okay, so Murder Knocks Twice is, as you said, it's set in 1929 Chicago, and it features a young woman, Gina Ricci, who is starting the first day of her new job as selling cigarettes and gum at a local speakeasy. And she's never been there before. And really, literally, the book opens with her walking into the speakeasy on her first day. And so, essentially, one of the things that she finds when she gets there is that she is replacing a woman who was in her position who died under mysterious circumstances. So she's already there and people are kind of asking her questions like, why are you here? Do you know what happened to the woman that was here before you? And so that's where I set up the mystery.
Mm-hmm. How difficult was it to write the plot or to figure out the plot?
Yeah, I did have to kind of think it through. I'm not, we often talk about someone being a plotter or writing by the seat of their pants, and I don't always plot out my ideas first, but I did kind of think I probably need to figure out who done it, because sometimes that's been my downfall, to kind of work out the murderer by the end of the book. So I've kind of learned.
I did the exact same thing.
Yeah, I've learned now. So I sort of knew some basic stuff about who had done the murder that happens in the book and why, but I had to kind of work out the plot as I went.
What was the toughest part for you aside from figuring out who did it?
I did have to research quite a bit about this era. I even though I'm a historian by training and I do teach some American history, I don't really know all the ins and outs of the daily life of Chicago in the 1920s. So I spent a lot of time looking at newspapers and magazines, and I watched some silent films and talkies, listen to music. I tried a lot of cocktails. So I did, I had to research, the time period.
Did you actually visit a speakeasy, or are there any speakeasies that are still speakeasies?
Yeah, there's a couple. The Green Mill in Chicago,
oh, sure.
I didn't base my story on that, but I I had sort of a visual of it a little bit when I was thinking about the book, but I looked at a lot of different pictures of speakeasies from other cities. There are not that many around, or if they are, maybe they're doing their job and being really quiet and low key and only certain people know about them.
Yeah, I bet you. That's so funny about the Green Mill. I set a few chapters there in my most recent book too.
Oh, cool.
And you know,
was
after
it current?
15.
Is yours current?
It came out in November, but.
I meant the time period.
Yeah. Current.
Yeah.
So, but I did have to talk about the tunnels underneath that Al Capone used to use when the cops would come in through front door. He'd go down in the behind the bar into the concrete tunnels and come out on Lawrence Avenue and escape. Huh.
Yeah. And, you know, that was one of the things I found out when I was researching the books for this new series, is that Chicago is one of the most tunneled cities in the country. And the tunnels existed prior to Prohibition. But I do think that that may have been partly why Prohibition worked so well, if you think of it that way, in Chicago. Certainly the area where I set my speakeasy, which is where University of Illinois Chicago is currently, or is now, I set it there. And there were a lot of tunnels underneath there that just preceded it from, you know, sewage and maintenance tunnels and things like that.
And there's a lot of stuff having to do with the lake underneath the tunnel, you know, in those tunnels too. So anyway, so aside from the research, was there anything else that you found easier or more difficult than the Lucy Campion stories?
You know, in some ways, I think the thing that was harder for me, I mean, my 17th century books were hard to work in some ways because, you know, everything was really different. I had to research a lot of things, and I do have a PhD in that time period. So, you know, I had to spend a lot of time thinking about those things. But the difference with the 1929 books is that my research, I had to make sure that I wasn't telling people what we already knew, you know, so I had to find different kinds of things and I had to research things differently. So I think that's partly, you know, trying to tell a little bit of a different story, even though it feels like it might be a kind of familiar world to a lot of people. There's still a lot of things that I kind of like upending people's assumptions about stuff. And that's, like, you know, something I try to do in the books.
Like, but, give me an example.
Well, you know, I think, and this is just sometimes just from my students, what they assume, you know, that they might think that, for example, that flappers and suffragettes were the same kind of individual. And while they both, you know, had a sort of a feminist understanding of themselves, proto-feminist maybe, but suffragettes, you know, wanting the right to vote, they also were the ones that were really insisting on prohibition and temperance, whereas, of course, flappers who are very modern in their outlook and in terms of sexuality and drinking certainly were not opposed to, you know, a drink. So, you know, so I think there's some assumptions there. I tried to like separate out how people understand these different kinds of women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got that. I actually, Gina, your protagonist, was pretty modern. To me, you know, I had no trouble relating to her and I liked her a lot. She was, I hate to say plucky. I hate that word. She had a lot of guts.
I like to say plucky.
She had a lot of guts. I love the way she decided just by herself, she was going to teach herself how to develop photos. That was really cool.
And I wanted to sort of build in some necessity, and I wanted her to be someone that can do stuff. You know, I wanted her to be someone, unlike myself, I wanted her to be able to, like, you know, fix a lamp and understand something about electricity, which is, you know, of course, this is the 20s. So, you know, there's a lot to know about that, or, you know, most people don't have like a working knowledge of that. And I thought it would be kind of interesting to have her someone who can fix things and can kind of figure out stuff.
Yeah, she can figure out radios too. That was pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wanted her to, you know, have, you know, because I have it in the story that her father is kind of a handyman and has been, you know, working, helping neighbors fix their stuff. And it's just something he developed. But then he has a palsy and he can't really do these anymore. And so I have it that she's sort of taking on this kind of job on the side to kind of, you know, help make some ends meet and all that.
Well, you did a good job with her. And you did a good job with the developing of the film too. I mean, that's I don't think it's really changed. If you, I mean, assuming we're not talking digital, I remember having a dark room and everything that you talked about, I still was using. You know, like 50 years later. So,
yeah, you know, I watched a lot of. This was different again from 17th century research. I watched a lot of YouTube videos where they're not from the era, but they'll show you how an old camera works and how. Because I really had to, I didn't know how many prints, you know, how much film, how do you load a film? And I mean, it's really not stuff I knew. Right. And so I had to watch a lot of video. And I was like watching step by step, what are these chemicals? And, you know, luckily you could get everything you needed from Sears and Roebuck back then. So, you know, so I knew that they could at least access it if they had to.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us about some of the characters in the book. I loved the, Madam, what was her name? Mrs.
Castellano.
Yeah, yeah. What did everyone call her?
Castellazzo.
Right. What did everyone call her? The Mrs.
Senora.
Senora. Senora. Right. I knew it was something with Mrs. She's mm-hmm. She was very intriguing.
Yeah, I thank you. I kind of like the idea that, you know, there's this, you know, this woman who's kind of leading up. I mean, she has her husband, Big Mike. They co-own the Third Door, which is the name of the speakeasy. But I wanted, you know, I wanted them to have different kinds of strength. You know, I didn't want these, my female characters to be kind of drippy or needy or, you know, I wanted them all to have a little, you know, backbone. And I just like the idea of her sort of managing this place and kind of, and people, and not just managing the place, but also, she has these, you know, kids working for her, and there's these storefronts that are all sort of, you know, I have a tea room and drugstore, and they're all kind of fronts. I mean, they're businesses. Mm-hmm. People can buy things from them, but, you know, they're all sort of fronts for the speakeasy. I kind of like the idea that someone could have this little, you know, place of power within a neighborhood that it's built up, even as these other big gangs are starting to really solidify around them, that there's still this like pocket of control by, you know, by someone like the Senora.
Right. Right. And she seemed at the end to be more, well, she was more powerful than her husband.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted her to be kind of a strong character. I don't always think of, you know, who actresses might be, but I was kind of thinking of, oh, see, now I'm going to call her Michael Douglas's wife, which is terrible. But she was
Chicago.
Right, she
right, came to, I know exactly.
She came to mind Catherine Zeta-Jones. I just had this thought of her as sort of
She's
this powerful
perfect.
Woman.
She would be perfect. Mm-hmm. And then there's some of the, then there, tell us about the guys in the back, the soldiers in the back who drank
there. So I had, my ex-servicemen in the back. These were all men that, American soldiers who had, gone through the Great War, of course we call it the, you know, World War One, and they had come out of that war, you know, with different kinds of wounds, some of them visible and some of them not, and you know, some of them did, they were damaged by, you know, gas masks and, or, you know, gassings and by grenades and, you know, all the terrible atrocities that happened in World War One. I mean, I wanted them, you know, they are there, you know, we didn't have as many American soldiers as, say, you know, Europeans were in the war, but, you know, they're still around. What happens to these men? And I, you know, and they basically have, I mean, now we would call it PTSD, but, you know, they called it shell shock, you know, back then. And, you know, I wanted to say, you know, I wanted them to, they're still part of the world, but, you know, they have this back room where they're gambling, where they're drinking, and where they can kind of be themselves socially, but not having people staring at their, you know, misshapen features and things like that. And I just thought, just kind of wanted to work in these other people into the book. I mean, they're not major characters, although one of them I do bring into my next story more substantially, but, you know, but I kind of wanted them in and out of the book.
Yeah. How did you come up with the idea of having World War One veterans?
You know, it's, I think it's just me as a historian, because I spent so much time thinking about all the different people that you can encounter. And I think, like, where do they go? Well, they're around, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, some survive. And I don't know. I think it's a funny thing as a teacher of history. I mean, I'm always like looking at my students and imagining them in different contexts. And of course, I used to have freshmen, young men, women, and you think, okay, well, they would have been the soldiers and that's what they would look like. you know, so I sort of visualize them in different kinds of soldiers' uniforms. And
let me
I just always place them in there.
Let me follow up with that for a minute. What is it about history that made you become not only to study it, but made you become a teacher or a professor?
You know, yeah, you know, I didn't really know that I would become a historian or a writer of historical mysteries or, you know, historical fiction. But I can kind of see it in, you know, my choices that I read when I was a kid. I read a lot of like young historical fiction, nothing really notable that people would just know, but I, you know, it was something I gravitated to when I was reading, although I did read pretty extensively mysteries and all kinds of other books. Always interested in like why things are, like, why do we have the name of this? And why does this street say that? I mean, even when I'm driving around, why do we have that? Just mm-hmm. always interested in the why.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have those little orange books that were historical biographies of famous people when you were in grade school?
No, I don't remember those. And I have to admit, I don't really like historical biography, which is kind of funny. They had to tell me to add real historical figures into my book this time. My first series, I mentioned people like King Charles II or, you know, I put in some famous Quakers, but of course people were like, we don't really know famous Quakers in my first series. So my editor pretty much told me, you have to make sure you put in some recognizable figures. So that's why I have, you know, Amelia Earhart and, right. you know, Jane Addams and people like that in there. But I kind of shied away from having real people in my books because that just takes another level of research to get it right. But, you know, I tried.
No, I think you did a good job. The other thing that I liked about the way you portrayed your characters, not necessarily the realistic ones, was that I was pretty sure the Senora was going to be a bad character.
So don't give away anything.
I was sure. And sure enough, no. Anyway. And you kept me on my toes. Person that she takes an interest in, could have gone either way too. You know, I wasn't sure. And the girls, well, you know, there were several girls, and it took me a while to keep them straight. But once I did, that was fine. And there was a question I wanted to ask you about the clothing that they wore. You know, mm-hmm. Gina gets this green dress that she wears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think, and she thinks it's beautiful. And I'm like, now where did you research that to find out exactly what cigarette girls and flappers or waitresses at a speakeasy would wear?
Yeah. You know, that's really fun to look up, you know, 1920s advertisements, newspaper advertisements, or Sears and Roebuck, or the Sears catalog. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're easy to find. I mean, you pretty much can just Google 1920. And I actually tried to be very specific, 1929. So what I did was I found one that was sort of like, it said ideal for secretaries. I mean, that's how it was advertised. And it was basically a picture of that dress. That's why I have such detail, because luckily the manufacturer writes it all out. Like, it has these buttons and it has this kind of sewing. And like, because that's, you know, and maybe nowadays they still do that to some extent. Yeah. But it was very clear. So it was easy. I was like, oh, I have this great picture. I can see why she thinks it's great, because she doesn't usually dress like this. But then they're all saying, you look like a frump. And this is totally wrong for like, because she hasn't really been to speakeasies. She's just not, she's modern, but they're expensive and she doesn't have much money. So she's right. not like, I mean, and she's not really having a man taking her around to places. So she's just not kind of on the nightclub circuit, really.
Yeah. Well, that's going to change as you get deeper into the series, I bet.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. She definitely changes in what she's used to doing too, and how she behaves. And, you know, this is a world that's becoming her world. Mm-hmm. At first she's an outsider, but certainly by the second book, she's much more inside.
Right. So tell me, of the girls, not including Gina, which one did you personally like the best?
You know, I kind of like them all. Of course, you kind of like your characters in different ways. But, you know, I did like Jade, who is, my Caribbean singer, I have her, you know, with green eyes, though it's a little obvious in that sense, but I could imagine if someone is born with green eyes that, you know, someone would take that as a stage name. I'm not sure if I've given that information yet, which way it is for her. But, you know, I kind of liked her being kind of tough and, you know, all of them, I think, have different kind of toughness in different ways. So that's partly, you know, why I like them all. You know, they're fun. They're all fun to write. You know, I tried to make them as distinct as possible. But I can also understand when you read them as a group, you know, it takes a little bit of time to differentiate them.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. But then I like Jade. I like Jade and I liked the girl who gave her the job, who told her about
Lulu.
The job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought Lulu was kind of, you know, she's kind of flighty in a way, but she's good-hearted,
you know. It's a good name, Lulu. So let's step back for a second and tell me how it was that you went from loving history to writing historical mysteries.
You know, so basically when I was researching my PhD work or master's and PhD work, I was reading murder ballads, 17th century murder ballads. And, back then I was writing something on patterns of domestic homicide in 17th century England. It was sort of like, this was for my master's. How men murder differently than women, and men use the implements of trade, and women use the implements of the home. And
How did you decide to home in on that?
Well, I think that's the part of me that's always been interested in mystery. And, you know, I always like that stuff. And so to me, it was really interesting. I will say that my PhD advisor did not let me do that for my doctoral work. She's like, that's fine for master's work. You can't do it for your doctor. However, I was able to use all my research still in my first books, no matter what.
Oh,
but so when I was researching it, you know, I eventually came up with, you know, I kept reading these murder ballads, and over there was the same theme of a young woman who had been found strangled or stabbed. And in her pocket, there was always this note. And it would say, like, dear sweetheart, meet me at the secluded glen at midnight. Don't tell anyone. And it would say, your sweetheart. And it would say, like, John or Q or OJ. And they would find this, and this was in the 17th century, and the community would find this young woman and her note in her pocket, and they'd say, oh, we know who John or Q or OJ is. And they would round up this guy and throw him in prison, and eventually he'd be brought to trial. And back then they viewed people as you had to be proved innocent. That was in the 17th century. And so he would usually be found guilty and hanged. And I always thought, and you'd see the same theme over and over and over reported. People sang about this murder ballad. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking, who's this woman? Was this man framed? And that became my first book. So A Murder at Rosamund's Gate is the answer to those questions. So that's how I moved from sort of being a historian to a writer of historical fiction.
Gosh. Now, how difficult was it to transition from writing a thesis or writing academically to learning the craft of fiction?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing. When I was writing this book, you know, the one I just said, I was just writing it little piecemeal over 10 years, just seeing here, seeing there, da da da, it was just a hobby. And then, you know, I was about 200 pages in, and my younger son, who was 2 at the time, broke his leg, and it was a terrible break, and I had to stay home with him. And I couldn't go to work. And so when I was playing with him, I would have like my left hand, I'm playing with Thomas Trains or building blocks. And my right hand, I was finishing my novel longhand. You know, I was just writing it.
Wow.
And then I said to my husband, I always say this is the only secret I ever kept from him, 10 years. I said, I think I've written a book.
No kidding.
But then what I realized was I needed to get some, I started reading at that point of quite a few books on how to write novels. And at that point I was like, I need to work on this. So I took like sort of an academic approach. I went and found like 10 books on writing. I mean, after I'd written like 350 pages, and I'm like, novels have beginnings and middles and ends, like a play. structure. So yeah. So I did apply like sort of analytical academic thinking to writing a
book. Well, it obviously worked at some point. Because
yeah,
here you
yeah.
are.
Well, I wasn't sure if it was. I mean, I was like, what am I doing here? But it helped.
Okay. So the first book you wrote was the first one that got published?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
That's yeah, but you know, what's interesting though is I did, I was queering. I mean, I had to do all that. I didn't know anybody in the right. I didn't know about Mystery Writers of America or Sisters in Crime, which now I'm involved with both of those. I didn't know any about these kind of writers' organizations. I didn't know anybody who'd written a novel. And so I didn't know about queering. So I just started, you know, reading about queering. I mean, that's all I got. And so we started queering agents. My husband helped me compile lists and we, you know, one by one, and I was getting rejections. And so there was a point where, as a self-preservation tool, I set that book aside and I said, you know what, I think this means that I need to stop querying and I'm just going to work on a new book. And I'm like, I have an idea. I'm going to set it in 1930 Chicago on a college campus, a lot where I work. And I'm going to write this book instead. So I started writing a different book entirely. And then, but you know, like 8 months later, I said to my husband, we're coming home from Door County, and I said to him, you know, that first book wasn't so bad. I should query it again. Let me try it. And he said, Susie, I have been querying for you. Like, I've been sending out your cover letter. I mean, your query, you know, to, and he says it's out right now with several editors and some agents.
Oh,
and
my God.
Yeah.
Kidding.
And then it was interesting. Like a week later, I got a call from a press that, I had a two book deal, and I was actually kind of freaked out because I didn't have an agent. And then it was very easy to get an agent at that point to say, I have a two book deal in hand. Can you represent me? Cause I just didn't know what to do.
Right.
Cause I'm not being a lawyer. And then the agent negotiated that to give me a different book. But now that book, the one that I set aside, the 1931, I rethought that and it became the 1929 one that just came out this month. So
perfect. That is great. So you kept the secret from your husband for 10 years and he kept a secret from you.
Yes, exactly. I know it sounds kind of funny because we're pretty good partners, you know, but he was just trying to, like, you know, it's hard to be rejected all the time.
Oh, wow. What a guy. Well, that's terrific. So what is the hardest thing for you to do in terms of writing, in terms of your craft? What's the, is it dialogue? Is it narrative, setting? What do you find difficult?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. And it probably is different by book. I mean, it did take me a while to kind of settle on the tone.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's an echo there.
Oh, it might be me. Don't worry about
it. Yeah. I think that sometimes it's hard to, you know, to settle on the tone with the first book. You know, it takes, you know, it's like, what's the voice of the character? You know, I think that actually is a little hard. It's with a series though, it's easier. Once you have that tone and voice, it's easier to kind of maintain it. But I think that was, you know, it's just kind of hard. Like, what, you know, so this book ended up being a little lighter. Which was okay. I think it was partly because I was listening. I mean, seriously, I was drinking cocktails some of the time, not all the time. And I was listening to music, which I hadn't done with my first book. And I was listening to like upbeat 20s music. Mm-hmm. And I think that made the tone lighter, which was kind of funny to me because I could have written a little more gritty, but I didn't think that was what I want. I didn't want to go that direction. So I think that would be like one of the main things that for me, it takes a little bit of time. And I did try my hand at a contemporary, you know, something set in nowadays, but I couldn't work out the tone. Everything just kept coming out kind of snarky and a voice I didn't like. I was like, I think I better go back to historical for a while.
That's interesting.
You know, it does take some time. I don't know if you find that as well when you're writing.
Well, if it's a series, you know, I've got my two series where I have to not struggle, but decide what I need to do is in my historicals, you know, mm-hmm. and what the voice is going to be like. And right now I just started a new book about Vietnam. It's set during the Vietnamese War. And it's about two Vietnamese sisters. And I'm having a tough time, you know, establishing the right voice for both of them, because I want them to seem a little exotic and foreign, but to themselves, they're not exotic or foreign, you know.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's tough. And what do you find the easiest to do?
None of it's really like easy. It's all a little.
It seems like, easy.
I mean, I guess what I find fun. I mean, maybe I'll say, you know, I do find it fun to look up things like research and like how did radios work. I mean, I honestly, like, I had to find out for my next book, how exactly did they use the telephone in the 1920s? I mean, I am old enough to remember how to like use a rotary dial. Right. So I'm not like, I do know that. And I know how how it was the neighborhood and the number. And that's how it was in Philadelphia too. Cause I was like GR3, Greenwood 3 in Philadelphia. And I did find the Chicago codes. And so, but what I couldn't figure out was, you know, for example, like did they call an operator and then the operator dialed that patched them through, or like what were all those people with switchboards? And you know, so I couldn't quite figure out whether you could direct dial someone back then if you had the number or if it always still went through a switchboard. But luckily, amazingly, there's a whole video or it was a commercial that would, you know, basically be in front of movie theaters as a trailer, and it explained how to use the phone in 1927. I was that's pretty helpful. And you didn't need a switchboard operator because that's what they were trying to show you. Yeah. And I thought, that's how we did it.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Wait, there was something I was going to ask you. Oh, where in Philadelphia did you grow up?
I grew up in West Philadelphia. You know, Will Smith, not too far from him. You know, that's the joke. Well, West Philadelphia, born and raised, and it really was.
Yeah, really. Okay. I went to school there. So anyway.
Oh, where did you go to school?
I went to Penn.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So my sister's at Penn now. I'm a little more, over by St. Joe's, but yeah.
Yeah. Got it. So tell me what's next with the new Gina Ricci book.
Yeah, so that's coming out April 30th of this month, and book two, not yet named. It might be called something like Poison at the Third Door, because it's about a poisoning, because I figured, you know, you have cocktails, some poisonings will happen.
Sure.
But I don't have a title yet, because it hasn't really gone through, you know, the marketing process.
Right.
And then I'm working on, you know, others in that series. I'm working on book three in the series right now. And then I actually got a contract for a fifth Lucy Campion mystery. So I will get to finish that story up. So that'll be out next year.
Fabulous. Have you done that? I mean, have you already written it?
No, I have to write it. It's a little scary because I think both of them might be due the same day. So, you know, we'll see how that fun goes.
Okay, good for you. You may have to become a full-time author for a while.
I know, that would be fun.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think we've had a great talk, and I really, really thank you for taking time out to talk to us. And listeners, if you want to know more about Susanna Calkins and all of her books, go to her website, susannacalkins.com. And if you want to tell your friends to listen to this podcast, please direct them to SoundCloud or iTunes or Spotify or the other three or four outlets, which I can't remember right now. And thank you very much for tuning in to Second Sunday Crime, and we will be back again next month.